I'm happy to start your day. So we're done with dark matter, unless there's a question. So feel free to ask if you have one. And if not, then we'll head off into... So remember, the remaining two topics were dark energy and primordial fluctuations. And depending on... I wasn't sure exactly how the timing is going to go, but we have two lectures this week and then next week. And there's a certain amount of overlap between these two topics. And so so we'll see how we go. But we'll start with the dark energy. And like dark matter, so the dark matter part of the story was there's this great problem out there. You guys are kind of in this age group where there's these fantastic problems out there where most of the universe we know is there. We don't know what it is. You know, who could ask for a better problem than that to work on? And so dark matter and dark energy are part of that story. And so there's the fantastic problem aspect of it. And then there's the second, but like all like the dark matter, I want to have an undercurrent of a different message, which is what's the evidence? So what it is, because any kind of successful description of this stuff, you want to know what it is you're aiming at. And so you want to have a list of what the evidence is that's relevant to these problems. But also because this is a course, I want to sell tools. And so the dark matter was less, the tools there were more statistical mechanical tools. But the tools here are quantum tools. So I want to, the subtext here will be naturalness questions, which I know in your Beyond the Standard Model course you've hit already. And you should be warned that naturalness questions, they have guided the way we think about guessing solutions to theoretical problems for decades. And I would say that they're not smelling that good. So it may be that that was a blind alley. But if it is a blind alley, that's where we're going to learn the most, is what we got wrong there. So it's the argument is important to know. It's probably true. And so, again, the burden is on me to give you the evidence for why people think it's true. It's a good criterion to judge theories by. But you should be skeptical. And the reason, one of the main reasons to be skeptical is that for decades, people have been saying these arguments tell you that you should be seeing things at the LHC, for example, or in cosmology. And many of those predictions haven't really played out very well. So it's, but dark energy is kind of the smelliest. When you're going to pick at a problem, you want to go to where it's the smelliest. And the naturalist arguments stink in dark energy. So it's, and they'll either stink or they're going to be smell like roses, because what they do is they whittle down the alternatives that you can think of as viable theories to the point where there are none left. And so there's two ways to read that. It might mean that there are solutions to this problem that are natural, and when we find it, it'll be so rare that when we find it, it'll just be the way nature works, which would be the good way to have it happen if you have an investment in naturalness. But it may also be that that this is really telling you that this is not a useful criterion, and if so, then the question is why not, and what parts of the evidence that it was a good criterion should be kept, and what was misleading in that evidence. And then that's kind of the subtext, but then the tool is effective field theories, because we're now going to be starting to talk about quantum effects, and we're interested in how they gravitate. So you really are forced to, this is where the rubber meets the road for quantum gravity in practice, in the sense that these are where the observational questions are happening. Many of the important conceptual questions, of course, are not happening here. These will be aimed at long distance cosmology kind of aimed questions, which are not asking the same kind of interesting conceptual questions as you ask when you ask at very small distance quantum gravity, where quantum effects are huge. But important in all of those understandings is to know the domain of validity of classical calculations, which are the ones that normally dominate in cosmology. And so the subtext here will be what controls quantum corrections in a gravitational context? How do you know when you're going beyond the domain of your validity of your approximations? And the language for all that is effective field theories, again, in a way that is different from the way we use them in dark matter. So that's where I hope to go. And the primordial fluctuations will have the same kind of topics in them. And they have the advantage that that's a place where people have claimed that quantum fluctuations and how they gravitate have been seen. So it's the one example where people would claim an observation of a quantum fluctuation in gravity. And so if you want to compare that to observations, an assessment of your errors is important. Okay, so we're going to start off with what's the evidence for it. Its existence. And again, the criterion for a successful story is there has to be more than one line of evidence. And in the dark matter case, you saw that there were 6 or 7 lines of evidence. What's compelling about them and what's constraining about them is that they all point to the same kind of a picture. And so whatever, it gives you a way to try and distinguish amongst the proposals for explaining it. And you'll see that in the dark energy case, there is more than one line of evidence, which is good, but there's not anywhere near as many lines of evidence as for dark matter. And so what we want is, what we'd like to have is many lines of evidence. And we're not going to be completely successful at having many lines, but we'll have more than one is a good one. So the important thing, so the starting point, you know, what made the splash in the late 1990s was the discovery of the acceleration of the universe. So evidence number one is the acceleration of the universe. Of the universal expansion. So we know that the universe, you know, we have our metric, which we know and love. A squared of t times a spatial thing. Let's just call the spatial thing gamma ij dxi dxj. It's got this time-dependent factor. We know that h, which is a dot over a, is the thing that the Friedman equation tells us is equal to 8 pi g over 3 times rho. So it's measuring the energy density in the universe. If we know how this varies with a, we can integrate it to figure out how things are evolving in time. And acceleration, as you might imagine, is all about how things are evolving in time. So we're going to need to know, it's going to tell us something about what's around in the universe. So the way people measure this is they don't measure h as a function of time because, you know, we're here. If time is going that way, we're here. Here's our past light cone. We're looking at light coming to us from various sources along the past light cone. We don't have the luxury of looking at slices of time at various places and asking what's happening. We're just looking along this sample in the past. And so in practice, what people do is they are measuring the Hubble scale. They're measuring distances computed in various or measured in various ways as a function of redshift. So you have some mechanism for figuring out how far away something is, and that might be a luminosity distance. It might be that you know how bright it is, and so you look at how bright it appears to be, and then you figure its energy went in all directions, and so I'm getting a specific sliver of that. And the sliver will depend on how far away it is, and then from that I can figure out how far away it is. That would be the luminosity distance. It could be the angular diameter distance, where we have somebody gives you a ruler on the other side of the universe. Cosmology was an example of that, where we had the sound horizon at the moment that the photons decoupled was a known distance that we could figure out in terms of the properties of hydrogen. So you look at it, you measure the angle between the ends of that distance, you know the distance, you know, because you know what the distance is at the other end, and you know how far away it is, if you know how fast the universe is expanding, then you can figure out the distance based on the angular diameter. And so there's various ways in which you can infer distance, and you compare that to the redshift, and then the redshift is supposed to be related to the distance because remember that was just a over a naught over a. A was smaller, so yeah. So if someone gives you what d is a function of z, then its first derivative is going to tell you about h. The second derivative will tell you about the acceleration and the rate of change of h, and so on. And so if you knew how the universe was evolving, so you knew what a of t was, then you could figure out what d of z was. And it's everything always starts off linear. So d versus z is, for small z, has an expansion which is, there's HZ with some number which depends on exactly how you define D, but then there's a coefficient involving Z squared and so on. And the idea is that this first term is telling you what the Hubble scale is now, so H naught, and the next term is telling you something about what it's related to the rate of change of the Hubble scale now. So there was a program to measure, if you could measure things for Z, you need to be to test this relationship and to measure this coefficient, you need to know what D is for Z's that are not too small. So the program was you needed to measure distances to objects as far away as possible. And so what they did in the late 90s was the most distant D versus Z measurements. And they're measuring the luminosity distance. So they're taking something of a known brightness, use supernova. So they use type and they use supernova. Supernovae, because there's more than one of them. And what they use is that if you look at supernovae near us, there's a correlation between there's a correlation between the spectrum and the luminosity. And because they know nearby, they can measure them separately, they know there's a correlation. The assumption is that if that same correlation is true for more distant ones where you can't separately measure the luminosity, you can infer the luminosity using this correlation. And then that gives you, if you know the luminosity of a distant object, and then you measure how bright it appears to be, then you can figure out how far away it was. And the beauty of these supernovae is that they're very bright. They're as bright as a galaxy. So you can see them as far away as you can see galaxies, and so you can see them at appreciable distances. So the surprise was, so they went away, you go away and you start plotting the speed of recession, V of the object, the supernova, against distance, say D. And if the Hubble law were true, the Hubble law says that V should be HD. And if the Hubble law was strictly true, this would be a straight line. You'd get something like that. But what they're expecting to see was corrections to it, because they're expecting to see that the distance was actually not strictly linear. The redshift is a proxy for V. And so they're expecting the line to not be straight. And the surprise was, so there was a prejudice as to which way the line would bend, up or down. And the prejudice was that it would bend up, because the logic was, this law is saying, this is the law that this Hubble law is the law that suggests the Big Bang, right? It's the one that says, I look at objects, and all but maybe five or six galaxies are satisfying that they're receding from us. And the farther they are from us, if you kind of exclude the ones that are really close to us, this is a better and better description. There's a peculiar motion to do with them falling towards each other in clusters of galaxies. But the farther away they are, the faster the speed is that the peculiar motion is superimposed on. And so the better and better this becomes. But this kind of a law is easy to explain, right? If you had something where everybody left at the same point at the same time, then the ones that were moving faster would be farther away. And if their speeds were constant, this would be exactly what you'd expect, that the ones that are moving twice as fast are twice as far away. And so this, if you ran this back in time, thinking that the speed was a constant, then they would all arrive here at the same time. That sounds like that was an explosion. But the key if there was if the speeds were constant. We know that everybody in the universe is pulling on everybody else due to gravity. And the main thing going into the prejudice here was that gravity is always attractive. And because it's always attractive, in a spherically symmetric distribution, mostly what you feel is you feel a pull of who's closer to you to the center than you are, and you can pretty much ignore everybody who's farther away. So everybody's slowing you down. As you move away from the center of the explosion, everybody who's closer to the explosion than you is pulling you back. And because gravity's always attractive, no one's pushing you away. Everybody was expecting that the velocities of objects as you watch them in time should have been getting slower and slower and slower, so the universe should be expanding, but with a slower and slower rate. And so they were expecting a deceleration to the expansion of the universe. That was the universal expectation. And that means that if you measure kind of for various galaxies where they lie in this curve, you're expecting it to do something like this. And that sounds a little bit counterintuitive because the speeds here are actually higher than the extrapolation for linear speed. And that's because the reason this is consistent with things slowing down is when you see these objects, you're seeing them as they were when they sent you the light. So if you see something that's a long ways away, you're seeing it a long ways in the past. And so if it was slowing down, you're seeing it as it was before it slowed down. So the statement that the universe is slowing down in its expansion is the statement that as you, when you see things that are very distant, they'll be faster than they would be if you'd use the Hubble law for things in your in immediate vicinity. So that's why everyone was expecting this to happen. That was the, this is what you expect if the universe is decelerating. And of course, the reason that you beat on this when you explain it is that what they really found was something like this. And I'm exaggerating how much the deviation was, but it was statistically significant. So what they saw is the very distant objects, so as they were deep in the very distant past, for very distant means redshifts smaller than one still. It's kind of cosmologically distant, but not really enormous redshifts. And the, you know, the context was the redshift of the microwave background is 1100 or something like that. So we're talking about redshifts that are kind of in the vicinity of order one or less in these surveys. And you're seeing that they are actually slower than the ones that you would extrapolate from the people that are nearby you. And so that's evidence that that the universal expansion now is accelerating. So that means that the A dot dot seems to be bigger than zero. And the fact that that was a surprise, I've kind of spun it to you that everybody thought it was going to be here because gravity is attractive. So we should go back and say, well, if you're measuring it, this is true. To what extent are you measuring that gravity is not attractive? How impossible is that to have A dot dot being positive? And so the way to decide that is we go back to our expression that tells us how A is evolving, which is the Friedman equation, and we differentiate it. So if we differentiate ddt of h squared is equal to 8 pi g over 3 rho, that's going to give us A dot dot, but it's going to give us rho dot. But we know that rho dot satisfies the equation of energy conservation, which you remember was more usefully thought of as, or more physically thought of as being, you know, the rate of change of rho A cubed plus P times the rate of change of the volume is zero. So it's like the conservation of energy story. So if we use this in this, when we take the ddt, then we're going to get a formula for the rate of change of A involving only rho and P. But it'll involve P now because P is entering through this equation. And it tells us that A dot dot, you do the algebra, is minus 4 pi g over 3 rho plus 3 P. And that minus sign is the prejudice for things to be decelerate. Oh, your hands. You should, you know, if you have a question, shout it out because I may not look at you.
My question is, so we know that this is all like the background, the unperturbed metric.
Yeah.
And we know that in reality you have perturbations, right? So for example, I'm thinking here that we could have like peculiar velocities that would explain this, right? So the galaxies far to us are accelerating towards some other cluster or whatever.
Right.
So how can we tell this apart from this kind of?
That's a great question. So the question for everybody is that if you're looking back along light cone, then I'm telling a story which is where things are varying as a function of time, but you're saying, why didn't things vary as a function of space? Maybe we're living in a place where this is kind of maybe not exactly your question, but this is a way of spinning your question. And if I don't get you answer your question exactly, ask it again. But if you, one way in which you could, everything I'm telling you, the story could be that maybe we're living in a void where the density is a little bit less than it is really cosmologically. And so our local acceleration is different than it would have been kind of on average for the whole universe. And if you're only looking along light cone, then you can't really tell the difference between things that are varying in space from things that are varying in time. And so can't you describe the story that I'm trying to describe using an inhomogeneous geometry rather than a homogeneous but time-dependent in a funny way geometry? And that's a completely good question. And there's a degeneracy there. If all you have was one line of evidence, that would be a real degeneracy. And so that's where more than one line of evidence is important. But I think the short version of it is that you could contrive this to work, but the part of the other lines of evidence that you're trying not to screw up is that if there's a void, so that would be kind of a void picture where there's an underdense region and we're in here somewhere, One of the constraints will be, if you're in some region that's underdense, is that there will be a change to whether or not the universe is spherically symmetric. Because if we're over here, say, this direction should look different from that direction. And so a constraint on this kind of a picture is coming from the microwave background, where the temperature is really uniform to 1 part in 10 to the 5 in all directions. So people who make these kind of solutions, when they make them work, they make them work if we're kind of in here at the center to within some fairly small tolerance, which I think at some level is workable. That's, I think if you are happy just with the supernovas, then that kind of a picture, this degeneracy you can't get around, provided that you're staying in the middle sufficiently closely. But then it's because there's not a lot of lines of evidence, I think it's really hard to rule this out definitively. But the other lines of evidence are going to, there's other lines of evidence that are pointing to there being more matter. And I'm going to show you, so part of how compelling the story I give you will be how bizarre it looks compared to the alternatives. And so I think the right thing to do is to assess them, is to say that, so this is possible, so we should keep it in mind. And in the dark energy story, it's hard to really be dogmatic because I think none of the explanations are so incredibly convincing. But you'll see that the where I'm heading now is at face value, there's a very simple thing that can give you acceleration, but it has its own problems, and so you'll see that see what they are when we get there. Yeah, that was a great question. All right, so this is the minus sign that is the mathematics expressing this prejudice that gravity is always attractive because we're expecting the energy densities to be positive. And we should go back and think carefully about how dogmatic we need to be about the energy densities being positive. But at some level, we're measuring the energy densities because we're measuring something about the energy densities when we measure if the energy densities weren't positive, this would have been a tricky equation because h is h squared, and so you'd have to go back. I've used that the universe is flat, and there was a 1 over a squared term that was on the left-hand side here that I've dropped. And dropping it kind of presupposes that the energy density was positive. Otherwise, this wouldn't have made a lot of sense. So when you look at how to modify the sign of the right-hand side over there, the choices you make normally have other consequences, and one of them might be that you're saying that there's a curvature to the universe because this equation, if your way out of why a dot dot could be positive was that rho was negative, say, you have to then take seriously the idea that the universe spatially is curved, and then the evidence that this universe is not spatially curved is now evidence you have to deal with. So that's kind of part of this many lines of evidence being important story. But the way, when people give you assessments as to how much dark energy there is, they say there's 70% of the universe is dark energy, they've made a choice as to how they're making this be positive. And what they're doing is they're imagining that this is positive because they're happy with the Friedman equation, but they're going to allow you to have negative pressure. So the pressure is kind of more efficient at making things negative because if it's negative, this factor of 3, which is to do with there's 3 dimensions in space rather than 1 of time, is the thing that is... I said that like it was true, and I'm... 3s appear in a lot of ways. You know, don't hold me to. If it turns out that 3 is not to do with space time, then I shouldn't have said that. It sounded very deep, but that may not be true. Anyway, there's a factor 3 there. Important thing is that makes the pressure, gives it more of a lever arm than rho does. So a dot dot can be positive. If p is less than 0 or rho is less than 0, but in particular, if let me say it can be positive with positive rho. Let me go up where you can read it. If p is less than minus 1/3 rho, because that's what you would need to make this change sign. So that's kind of an observation, but it doesn't tell you whether or not that's compelling. So you have to then ask, so how hard is it to get negative pressure in the world? If that's the way you want to think of things, or negative energy if you want to think of it that way. So do reasonable systems do they ever give you rho less than 0 or p less than 0? You could certainly get rho less than 0. So example with rho less than zero, take a scalar field. Say your Lagrangian is minus 1/2. You know, there's a root g here. Minus 1/2. I'm writing this out because we're going to talk about scalar fields a lot. Minus v of phi. And the minus signs are here because I'm using the metric minus plus plus plus. So that means that the time dependence here is phi dot squared with a plus sign. And then the Lagrangian should have been kinetic minus potential. So this minus sign is the one that you want v to be positive. But you don't really want v to be positive. Normally, the arguments that v is positive are to do with so the kinetic energy here, so for homogeneous things, the stress energy for this thing would have been, if I take phi as a function of time only, with this metric that we've been talking about, then the stress energy happens to have this perfect fluid form, which is rho t mu nu plus p plus rho u nu, where u mu is the four velocity of the rest frame of the cosmic fluid. So the usual argument that leads to the FRW metric is you say that you're looking for geometries which are spatially homogeneous and isotropic, but you're not asking them to be Lorentz invariant. So you're giving yourself a preferred frame, but you're asking that frame to be rotational invariant and translation invariant. And this is the most general form that a stress energy can have, which is consistent with those symmetries. So it's not such a surprise that when you take phi equals phi of t, you can write it in this way in terms of an energy density and a pressure. It doesn't mean that you're thinking of it as being a fluid in the thermodynamic sense, but it's that's why rho and p are so useful. It's building in the symmetries of the cosmology. And we can calculate, if we just have this action, calculate t mu nu, you can read off what rho is for a homogeneous thing, and it's the usual thing you're expecting. It's going to be 1/2 phi dot squared plus v, and the pressure turns out to be 1/2 phi dot squared minus v for a homogeneous configuration. So that informs a little bit what your options are for the sign of rho. It sounds like this is always going to be positive, but you can imagine making v negative. Because, well, you could ask, can I make v negative? And the thing you would worry about is stability, but stability doesn't ask for v to be positive. It only asks for v to be bounded from below. You want to have the potential such that if, as you roll down towards its minimum, you eventually find one and stop. But there's nothing really there that says that the potential has to be minimized at a positive value. So stability demands v bounded from below. If not, then the question you have to ask is why is there a vacuum at all? Cosmology is the least of your problems if you don't have a vacuum. But once you have a vacuum, then there's nothing that says that v can't be negative there. Not that v is positive.
But can you really add something? I mean, you're saying that you can shift the potential and everything would stay the same.
Yeah.
But,
no, everything wouldn't stay the same. Gravity would know.
That's what I was about to ask. Yeah. The square root minus g. So is that, how can it be?
All I'm saying now is that as certainly if it was true that the shifting v didn't make a difference, then you wouldn't care if v was positive. But I'm making the case that the value of v does matter because it actually affects the value of the pressure and rho. That's one way of thinking about it. And it's just doing what you said. It's gravitating, so it's in there. So if you kind of ask where v was, v would sit in here. It's going to have a piece. The root g is going to give you a contribution to rho, and that's kind of how you can kind of see it's appearing there. But so the statement is not that it's not important what the value of v is. The statement is that we don't take random functions normally here because we do ask that we're talking about things that are stable. Because one of the things we normally build into any reasonable theory that's explaining a puzzle we have shouldn't screw up what we know already. And stability is an important part of that because we normally ask that there exists a vacuum. Because it seems to be true that there's a minimum energy state which seems to be the near us modulo of the Higgs field. It's consistent with the no particle state. And if we did not have a vacuum state, so if the Hamiltonian did not have a minimum energy state, then what we expect the system to do is it's just to cascade down to lower and lower energies, and then that's not what we see around us. And so that would be a very fast process that has nothing to do with cosmology. And so this demand that you have stability, so a vacuum exists, that's something which is not automatic for theories, but it's something which should be required of a description of cosmology because that's demanded by our experience in the solar system. Or if not, if you kind of evade a stability criterion, the way you so when you talk to people, there's a part of the reason I want to talk about the effective field theories and what controls quantum corrections is that sometimes when you have this stability discussion with cosmologists, what they'll say is that, well, the issue of a vacuum and whether or not quantum states can go down and down and down at lower energy, that's a quantum problem, and we haven't solved quantum gravity. So that's something which we'll just say, we'll solve that when we understand quantum gravity. In the meantime, we'll think about cosmology. And I want to argue that that's a weak argument because for two reasons, one of which is this is the statement normally that you have a classical description at long times describing cosmology normally is presupposing you don't need to understand all of physics at all scales to understand physics at long scales. And that's kind of why science progresses, that we can understand atoms without understanding nuclei. And that's because nature has this property called decoupling, which says that most of the details of small distance physics don't matter for long distance physics. And that's why you can understand the long distance on its own terms. And then you can, there are some things you need to know for an atom, about a nucleus to understand an atom. You need to know its charge and its mass, but that's basically it. But when you understand nuclei, you didn't need to understand quarks. And so it's generically true that nature comes to us with many scales, but they can normally be understood one at a time. And so any kind of an explanation that says that there's some very, very small distance physics, which is the quantum gravity physics that we haven't understood, that's affecting very, very long distance physics in a really important way, like the stability of the vacuum, undermines this whole decoupling of nature thing. And so the first thing you have to worry about then is, if you really have very small distance physics saving you from something you don't like about long distance physics in this case, you have to ask, why could I understand anything in long distance physics? Why doesn't it ruin my understanding of atoms, and why doesn't it ruin my understanding of condensed matter physics? This decoupling is sacred for the progress of science, and so it doesn't mean it's always true. There's some specific things about small distances that are very important for long distances, and identifying those things are really important in identifying what you're learning about small distances. But the fact that small distances hide from you is what makes quantum gravity hard to test experimentally. That's because it's things at the Planck scale are at very small distances. And so that's normally a good thing because we didn't need to understand it to make predictions about other things in life. But if you think you understand what's going on at the Planck scale, it's a barrier because it's hard to test those things. So stability normally, that decoupling story is really a theme in the naturalness story I'm going to say more about later on. But stability is what we would normally ask as a criterion. I said there was two things that were weak about the argument. One of them was you can't ignore quantum mechanics on long scales. The other one is the arguments for quantum instability are also arguments for classical instability. If you really have an unstable system, it normally will also be unstable classically. And so the way you'd see it classically would be go to something like a binary pulsar, which is radiating. And what will happen is that the instabilities that you would have had if your energy had been unbounded from below will show up as classical modes that will then like to run away towards those classical configurations with low energy. And so then that should ruin classical predictions like the radiation of pulsars. And so this stability is a very robust criterion. It's very difficult to make sensible things that don't satisfy the stability. If you look at not ruining, if you care about not ruining other things that we believe we understand. Long story short, though, is that nothing about that says that V has to be positive. And so the fact that it makes a difference gravitationally is if V were negative and a constant, that would be anti de Sitter space. It's a perfectly good stable solution of Einstein's equations with a negative and constant V. And it's one for which it's difficult to think in terms of this homogeneous curvature equals zero slices because it's, if rho is negative, this equation has to go. And so you have to go back to the possibility of having curvature on your spatial surfaces. But that's allowed by geometry, and so you can explore its implications. So there certainly are gravitational implications if rho is negative. But even if V is positive, and if rho is positive, and so the I'm not going to actually explore this being negative. This explicit sign also gives you options to have this be negative. And if that's negative, that's good enough from the point of view of this acceleration because of this factor of 3 here. All you need is that this has got to be true. And in particular, if phi dot squared is much less than v, even if for this to be true, it had to be true that since phi dot squared is positive, then v had to be positive. In that case, it's true that rho will be v, but p will be minus v. So this will be to good approximation that, and that'll be to good approximation minus rho. And that was one of the equations of states we looked at, right? We looked at the ratio, if the ratio, the ratio w defined to be p over rho, that was 1/3 for radiation, 0 for matter, or very small for matter, and minus 1 is one that I mentioned in passing. That's the dark energy run. So when people talk about dark energy quantitatively, what they're doing is they're choosing this normally as the, that's what they think they mean by dark energy. So W equals minus 1. And it's the kind of thing that you can access very simply in a simple model like this by putting yourself in a regime where, for whatever reason, the kinetic energy is being dominated by the potential energy. So typically, that's usually requiring your potential energy not to be too steep, because if it had been steep, that would have given you kinetic energy, the fact that you would roll down the hill. So this is the slow roll regime. So phi dot squared much less than v is called the slow roll regime. And it usually requires v to be shallow in some sense that I'm not making precise yet, but I will come back to. And because that'll be one of the things that's problematic about it. Okay, I kind of got off on a big tangent there, so. So it's not crazy to have rho be negative, not crazy to have p be negative. And p being negative is even easier than having rho be negative because it's not really a big deal because nothing says that v has to be positive as long as it's bounded from below. So if we're allowed to do those things, then it sounds like it should be possible to have a dot dot be negative. And in this particular case, so w equals minus 1, it satisfies in particular that this criterion here says that w is less than minus 1/3 should be good enough to give you, if rho is positive, that should be sufficient to give you acceleration. And so this should be well in that regime. And we can check that because we know what all the solutions were. We know that if w is equal to minus 1, we know that rho is a function of a from energy conservation. There. If w is minus 1, that says that p plus rho is 0. So that says that rho dot is 0. So that means it's independent of a. And that sounds weird. We've got an expanding universe where the density of energy is constant. How did that work? How is this possible, given the expansion? You know it's consistent with energy conservation because that is energy conservation, and that's how we got it. And what's happening is that when you think of energy conservation in the way that I also wrote here, I thought at one point, and probably I erased it. If you think of it in terms of ddt of rho a cubed plus p ddt of a cubed equals 0, if rho is constant, then the volume of space means that you've got more energy. That's what this is saying. The fact that this is something which is changing because the universe is expanding. What's happening is, this is a p, that's working, that's consistent with this energy conservation because p being negative means that you're, as the volume changes, you're doing work, but it's negative work. So it's the opposite sign to what you're normally expecting a gas to do. And essentially what you're doing is the energy that you're producing by having the universe expand and keeping rho constant is coming to you from the negative work that you did is from the expansion of the universe. But it only worked for the specific choice of p, where p is minus rho. So that's a very special choice. So it's p equals minus rho does just the right amount of work. to allow this. And that also smells like the vacuum, right? The vacuum is something where you think it just sits there, it's not doing anything very interesting. If it had an energy, probably it would be constant. So this is kind of suggestive. So where I'm going with this is that the pitch I'm making to you, I'm halfway through, is that the equation of state, W equals minus one, is the equation of state that the vacuum would very likely have, given that the vacuum appears to be very Lorentz invariant. So it's the only Lorentz invariant vacuum. Whereas this did not assume a Lorentz invariance, it assumed homogeneity and isotropy in a specific frame, but there was a preferred frame given by the fluid that is driving cosmology. If you ask for a Lorentz invariant stress energy, it has to be proportional to G mu nu, and that means this had to vanish, and so that's why P equals minus rho is picked out by Lorentz invariance. And the first sign that you see that that's coming is here, because the vacuum, your intuition about the vacuum is that it just sits there, and so the energy density would be constant. And so the equation of state that Lorentz invariance give you is doing what you expect it should do. So rho equals constant, smells like the vacuum, vacuum energy density. And so more evidence for this is that so the most general vacuum stress, most of it, let me say that. So there's good evidence that the vacuum now is Lorentz invariant. So let me write them down and I'll discuss them in a second. Point number one, and the only Lorentz invariant equation of state is W equals minus one, which is to say that's T mu nu is a constant times G mu nu with lambda equals constant. The lambda equals constant conservation of stress energy. If that holds for this piece of the stress energy by itself, is what would tell you that lambda had to be constant.
Why does the second part of E mu reflected after P0 for this to be
constant? So you're saying why is this following from Lorentz invariance? Yeah, so I haven't made that argument yet, but it's a good question. So let me do that one first then, because basically what's happening is that you're asking that the vacuum to give you a stress energy, and this thing, whatever it is, should be a Lorentz invariant tensor. So what you want to do is you want to take all of the killing vectors that you would need. You're saying there, it should give rise when it gravitates to a geometry which is Lorentz invariant 2, so it should have isometries. If all you had was this and nothing else, then it should give rise to geometries that are Lorentz invariant, and they would have killing vectors which would generate the flows of Lorentz transformations around the space-time. And then you could ask, what are the tensors? What's the list of Lorentz invariant tensors with two indices that are symmetric that I can make? And that's something which you don't need to know geometry for, right? If I just said, supposing we were talking about the tangent frame, and we're just looking at tensors that were not moving you around the space-time, but just looking at how you did local Lorentz transformations at the tangent frame, and you ask, what are the invariant tensors of the Lorentz group? There's two of them, right? There's Lorentz invariant tensors are basically A to AB, because that's the definition of Lorentz transformations, that they leave this alone. And the other one for proper Lorentz transformations is that ABCD, the Levi-Civita thing, is invariant under the ones that have unit determinant. But if you define your group to be the group of, you know, if your group is 0, 3, 1, so it's defined to be the group of transformations, four-dimensional things with a signature minus plus 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 that preserve this metric, then that group, if that was the definition of your group, this is the only invariant tensor you have. If you make the extra condition that this is, you know, it's unit determinants, then you get one more tensor, But that's the whole list. All the other tensors are transforming under this, because that's how you define your group, basically. So now, if you transform, use your fear bind to go to the from the tangent to the world indices, then the A to mu nu, A to AB turns into the metric, and so the metric is the only one you have that's invariant. So the symmetry argument is telling you that this is the only thing that could happen at the level of a fluid. So a subset of Lorentz transformations is isotropy and homogeneity. Or actually, homogeneity is more like Poincaré transformations. You can also see that it's true, because in that case, this is the thing that's preferring a frame. So if you ask kind of in this problem, what is it about this term that's different from this term? This term doesn't prefer a frame, but this one is defining a frame. It's the frame where U is pointing in the time direction. That's a special set of observers. Those are the co-moving observers. And they exist because there had to be a frame in which the universe was isotropic and homogeneous. If it was true for one observer, it won't be true for someone who's moving through that frame. So that there's the conditions of homogeneity and isotropy mean that there's a preferred class of observers, and this is their four velocity. So if you wanted to have something Lorentz invariant, you had to kill this term, and that's kind of another way of seeing why P plus rho had to vanish.
Because we're in cosmology, right? We use the concept of vacuum and the concept of cosmology. So we can't really talk about Lorentz transformations anyway, right? Because dt is not a Killing vector. I mean, we only have spatial.
You need to distinguish between tangent frame Lorentz transformations and geometries that are, because what you're saying is that, and it's true, that if you ask for your space-time to be Lorentz invariant, in the sense that you move it around, there's Killing vectors that move you around, then that forbids most of these geometries and leaves you with the Sitter space and anti-Sitter space and flat space. But what we're asking here, what you normally ask is you ask the tangent frame to be Lorentz invariant, and then the existence, whether or not that transfers, having a symmetry that moves you around the space is the question if, you know, the thing that relates the tangent frame to the, if here's your space-time and here's your tangent, the thing that relates vectors here to motions in the manifold is this thing, which is related, you know, to the metric by the usual E mu A, E mu B, E to B. And it's this thing, before you talk about this thing, you have Lorentz invariance on the tangent frame, and you have general coordinate invariance in the space-time. But once you say that your background has chosen something like this, the most you can hope for in a symmetry in that case is something which, this could be invariant, but it won't be separately invariant under coordinate transformations or under Lorentz transformations, but there can be combinations of them that leave this invariant if you kind of compensate what you do here with what you do here. And that's what's happening in those space-times you're talking about, that they're Lorentz invariant in the tangent frame and they're Lorentz invariant in space-time because this combination, you're letting them cancel each other. But this is a weaker condition. This is really only asking that the tangent frame Lorentz invariance is holding. And so that's why the ISO would have been the Poincaré part of things, where you're translating things around, and I haven't been talking about that.
No, also I meant ISO3 just on the spatial slice.
Yeah, that was built into this. That was the you know, homogeneity part of it, right? But this part of the argument, I'm not using that. Yeah. Okay. There's one final thing I wanted to say here, I think. So the upshot of this is that I haven't told you what the evidence was that the vacuum is Lorentz invariant. So the evidence that the vacuum is Lorentz invariant is coming from, it's not perfect. The best tests of the Lorentz invariant of the vacuum are, you can always imagine, there's very good constraints on the rotational invariance of the vacuum, and that mostly comes from, you look at atoms, you can measure frequency differences very, very accurately. And atoms that are supposed to be rotation invariant, there's often levels that are degenerate because of the rotation invariance. And if you had a preferred direction in space, those would be split by some small amount, and you're very sensitive to those splittings because you can measure frequencies so well. But that's rotation invariance and not Lorentz invariance. But the bounds on Lorentz invariance typically come from the fact that we know that we cannot be at all times at rest. If there's a preferred frame in which things are rotational invariant, we know that we're not in it at all times. And we know that because we're on an Earth which is rotating and the Earth is going around the sun, and so we're not moving along a straight line. So at some point, we're always moving compared to this preferred frame if it exists. So what people do is they look for violations of rotation invariance that depend on time of year with our motion around the sun, say, or depend on time of day with motion of the rotation of the Earth. Because if there was a preferred frame, even if it was rotationally invariant, if we move through it, then we're giving a preferred direction to things, and then atoms could respond to that by not being exactly rotationally invariant because they would see the fact that they can interact with the vacuum, and the vacuum has a preferred direction, and that would split these levels that are known not to be split. So the whole thing, to make it precise, you need to know, you have to know how the atoms couple to whatever it is in the vacuum that makes it not Lorentz invariant, if you're breaking Lorentz invariants. And so the way I'm telling it to you, it tells you that it's poison to have anything electromagnetic talk to the Lorentz breaking physics, because atoms are seeing electromagnetism. So the constraints on having an electromagnetic component of the vacuum, which is breaking Lorentz invariant, are at the part of, they're better than 1 in 10^20. It's like they're fantastically accurate, because you've got fantastically accurate measurement of spectra. And we know that rotational invariance is really good always, and there's no motion of us moving through a frame. So if you're in the business of breaking Lorentz invariance, you have to hide it from atoms, basically, and hide it from strong nuclei as well. So it's not impossible, but all the evidence is that it's Lorentz invariant. And if it is Lorentz invariant, that Lorentz invariance tells you the equation of state, and that's exactly one which would allow you to accelerate. So when people tell you that the density of dark energy in the pie chart of the world that people always draw, where baryons are 5%, dark matter is 25%. I guess that would be 3/4. So dark matter is something like 25%. And then the rest of this is dark energy. What they mean is, they mean that there's something in the universe which has an equation of state, which is this. That's very plausible from the point of view that it could be the vacuum. And if you use that in cosmology, that would give you acceleration, because that satisfies that this, if it's dominating, which it would be if these are the pie chart, it would be giving you something negative there. And so that means A dot dot would be positive. But it's a statement about because it's telling you how things evolve in time, it's a statement not only of what the proportions are now, but what they are into the past. And so it's a very specific statement about how things evolved as the universe evolved. And remember, you've seen this plot before, but if you take log of rho against log of A, we always had that radiation was doing something like that, and the matter was doing something like that. And then if it's true that we're talking about a Lorentz invariant vacuum that's giving you the acceleration of the universe, it's doing something which is not depending on A at all. And then we would be living here, where this is 70%, that's 25%, and this is 10^-5. And if I had drawn the baryons, they'd be kind of doing something like this. This is the baryons. But you can see that if you go back in time at all, to say, if this is Z equals 1100, where decoupling happened, say, you don't have to go back very far at all. There's this transition between the dark energy, the vacuum dominating to matter dominating, that's happening at red shifts of an order of a few. So it's maybe 1 or 2 or something like that. And so, and you can work out what it is, because you know that matter is going like 1/A³, and dark energy is doing nothing, and you know the relative proportion now. So if you go back to the CMB, it was mostly radiation. If that pie chart would have been mostly radiation, the rest of it would have been dominantly dark matter, and then the fraction of baryons to dark matter is the same fraction as there, so it's like 1 in 5. And so the pie chart is very different in the CMB time, and that's kind of part of what makes it, our ignorance of dark energy doesn't really affect the understanding of the CMB very much, because it's such an incredibly small effect there. And there's one last thought I wanted to get from that. That was, I'll do that next time. So the statement that people make, which is the thing I was trying to set up here, is that this is coming from what they call a concordance cosmology, lambda CDM cosmology. And the concordance part of it is the part of it that says that there's more than one line of evidence. So the statement that you need 70% of the universe to be dark energy is partly to do with the fact that you need to have A dot dot positive, and that has to be consistent with what they saw with supernovae. But it's also true that there's other lines of evidence that will have to be consistent with it. And the concordance part of it is coming from there. And effectively, there's one more piece of evidence that I haven't mentioned, and that is that this whole thing had this plus this plus this had to add up to the total energy density. And the total energy density is controlling the Hubble scale. And that's also controlling, and the Hubble scale, the Friedmann equation, whether you include the curvature term or not, is determined by how big it is compared to the energy density. And so measurements of the curvature of space at a given time are telling you about the total energy densities of around now. And the fact that I told you that that's consistent, the spatial geometry is consistent with being flat, another way of saying that is that that's consistent with the total energy density being consistent with being critical in size. And so that says that the total sum of this plus this plus this has to add up to 10 to the minus 29 grams per cubic centimeter. And that's a separate check on how big. We know how much we have here. We know how much we have here. We think supernovas are telling us how much we have here. So we can, in principle, add them up, and we know what the answer has to be. So that's a separate check on this picture. And I might as well draw the graph now. So what you usually see is people present you this information in a plot, which is the density of dark energy, assuming that it's that equation of state, and the density of dark matter. And then this would be none of both. So this is zero for no dark energy, no dark matter. And then they'll show you a plot of what the supernova data requires. And it's something like this. So the supernova wants you to live in here somewhere. And it's away from no dark energy. That's kind of the statement that you see the universe accelerating. And then this is some measure of the error that you have. And then there's a line that they draw, which is the line of a flat universe. So if the universe had been flat, spatial slices. So that's the cap equals zero line. And then they'll draw what the CMB gives you, and it's some curve that is not quite there. It's something like that. And what's going on there is that remember it's this argument that you've got a triangle. This is the sound horizon on the other side of the universe. This is the angle between the hot and cold areas and the CMB. And this is the size of the universe, which is really given to you by measurements of the Hubble constant. If you know all three of these things, then you've overdetermined the triangle. You can tell the geometry of space. And so this dotted thing is what you would have gotten from the CMB for different measurements of the Hubble value, because people are never quite sure what it is. And so then changing that value changes the argument qualitatively. And so it doesn't quite track. The CMB does not quite track flat space if you go to extreme values of this thing. But if you take the measured value of the Hubble constant, then you're just really down here somewhere. And so one of the successes is that this flatness argument and the Hubble argument are agreeing with what the supernova require you to have. But you separately can measure the amount of dark matter, because all the evidence for dark matter we've talked about tells you you have to live in here, it turns out, because that's what you need to get the galaxies right. That's what you need to get the baryon acoustic oscillations right, which I have not talked about, but it's another thing that you can measure. And so the sweet spot is that these things are all agreeing on that region. So this 70% and this 25% is coming. The reason they call it concordance is that you have three things which are all kind of telling you the same thing about the, and part of that was the dark matter story, but part of it is also the dark energy story. And that's a good place to stop. So the tutorial and the next class, I'm going to talk about calculating the, so the question with the vacuum energy, the last word on vacuum energy will be, it's actually a good description observationally. If you kind of ask the measurements on W, they say that W is less than minus 0.9. So it's consistent with minus 1. But the real issue with dark energy is vacuum energy is its size, how big it should be. So I'm going to switch over to calculating the quantum corrections to the vacuum energy. And I want to do it in curved space, not in flat space. And so the tutorial is partly that. And I'm going to duplicate part of the tutorial information tomorrow. So setting up how you do these vacuum energy calculations in curved space. And then you'll see that there's many ways to calculate it. They all give you the same answer, basically. We'll talk about that next time.